radiation, I'm sorry, it's just not dangerous as people think. And before this Bayes Committee in the United States came up, the radiation standards were actually reasonable. That is why nuclear power was much more affordable in the 1950s than it is today, because they came with these ridiculous standards that increased the safety requirements, and that almost doubled the price. Now, you can obviously see why the oil industry would want to lobby for something of this sort. And unfortunately, Germany, if you go to Germany today, a lot of the Greens in Germany, they came to be known as LNT activists, linear no-threshold activists. So they're using the fraudulent model to say that radiation causes leukemia in children, it causes this and that, you can turn green if you touch it. And consequently, the bad model has convinced an industrial sophisticated society like Germany to get rid of its nuclear weapons, and it's also radicalized the Austrian Greens, for example. So here's a clear example of what we talked about earlier, scientism influencing public policy. And obviously the oil industry is never going to oppose this, the Greens are never going to oppose it, because now they have solar and wind panels to sell. But the reality is radiation is not as dangerous, it's a very poor carcinogen, you need a very high dosage to make the carcinogen. And if you look at where this model comes from, because they had scientific studies behind it in commas, it was a guy who won whose name was Müller, he won the Nobel Prize, I think it's in the 1940s or somewhere, for basically shooting fruit flies with a lot of radiation. So modern radiation safety standards is based on three fruit flies. That's how shocking it is. At the time when they wrote the standards, they had actual human data from the atomic bomb tests in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So it's a repeated experiment. And those things show a very interesting thing. The survivors of the atomic bomb, you can measure it in terms of perimeter. So the radiation closer to the bomb, you have higher radiation. There's a certain level where there's an inverted J-shape, where the population has less cancer than the average, than the general population. And that is what we call radiation hormesis. So a certain amount of radiation might be good for you. Now, if you go into the, you're exposed to sunshine, for example, you tan. And you know, that tan protects you against more sunshine in the future, more UV radiation. Okay, so it's the same thing for all radiation. A little bit of it might be good for you. A lot of it is obviously going to kill you. And so we're talking about what they call the hormetic model, the inverted U shape or a J shape if you turn it around. And that's the model that I'm advocating for. And I say, if we base public policy on that, we can make nuclear power much more affordable. We can probably save a lot of people from dying from cancers because people forego radiotherapy because they're scared of radiation, things of that sort. So this is one of the most expensive scientific mistakes in human history.
Okay, welcome to the show, Hugo Kruger. My name is Kevan Davani. I'm the host of the Kevan Davani Connection Show. A huge honor and a pleasure to have you. I've been a fan of yours for some time now. I started reading your article on Substack. The content that you put out on Twitter is just fascinating. It's just really very succinct, very in-depth. Primarily, of course, on nuclear technology. So welcome to the show, Hugo. How are you doing?
Thank you very much. You know, it's nice to be with you. So I just give your listeners a background, I suppose, in me. I'm a structural engineer. I stay in France, but I'm actually from South Africa originally. And I have a master's in nuclear technology. And to add complications, my wife is from Iran. So I did a lot of research on the geopolitics and the Iranian nuclear thing. And that's sort of how we got into contact, I suspect.
How did you start like focusing or concentrating on these topics that you put out, that you publish on Twitter and on Substack? Like, what was the motivation, the incentives, or the drive that?
It's interesting because I don't even know if I can put them all together. So a lot of it has to do with energy related stuff. I work in the energy sector, and I thought I'd just share some of my experience, things that I know that engineers sort of instinctively know. And you know, engineers always have the problem, we think everyone knows what we're knowing. So I'm just sharing basic stuff of that sort. And then also I did a lot of, when it comes back from university, I read years ago Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and how groupthink happens in scientific thought, and you know how much resistance to change there is in institutions. People just don't want to change their mind. They would stick with the same story, even if it sounds absurd. And then all of a sudden, the next morning, they all change their religion, and then they believe you, you know. And I've seen a lot of this thing in the energy sector, and particularly as it relates to Germany now going crazy with its nuclear policy. And I think Austria is also sort of in the forefront of this type of thinking in Europe, unfortunately. And it's a lot of it comes down to groupthink for me. It's not a scientific. They use science and they use technology as sort of the way they brand themselves. But if you go through the veneer, it seems more like a religion, than science, really.
Yeah. Is that the word, like scientism also, when it comes to this whole COVID, whatever, scientific fraud and manipulation, or the so-called, it used to be a global warming, now it's got climate change.
Yeah. I mean, it's science by media, right? So soon as a scientist comes, they put out a statistic, which is ominous, doesn't mean much, but then the media captures none of the story. And then the media narrative becomes more important than the scientific one. So that's sort of the scientist process, how it starts. Okay. COVID was, in my view, a complete scam from the beginning.
Totally.
I interviewed David Rasnick on my YouTube channel, on Odyssey, because YouTube sent us into it. David Rasnick worked with Kerry Mullis, who invented the PCR test.
Yeah.
And when I realized very early on how this test works, I said, well, this thing cannot possibly do what the establishment is claiming it's doing. So all the data, all the stats you're seeing, it's very bogus. I've got no confidence in that. The only thing you can look at is a dead body. And then if you look at, for example, what Denis Rancourt did in Canada, he traced all-cause mortality with deaths, and he shows the government interventions, the media narrative killed the people. It's not a virus, So yeah, that's one example of this. Global warming is another one. I've done a lot of research into how that started. It's a very similar one. 1989, James Hansen goes to the US Congress and he tells them it's been the warmest year on record. At that point in time, NASA's budget was about to be cut. So they were looking for a story to scare the public to get the funding.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that was a very, you can almost say, innocent, sort of lie. But what the scientists at the time didn't expect is that there was already a big environmental movement who would jump onto this issue and throw them money. And now they got prestige and famous and everything. And all that follows from that is just sophisticated quackery, really, with the global warming story. I was looking at another issue which was very similar. It's like dogmatic issues is the HIV story. I wrote an article about this. I was in South Africa. And the same story as COVID. I don't believe that, in South Africa, they said our prison killed 250,000 people. But if you actually go into the details, what happened is at the end of the apartheid regime, the government made an effort to record the black deaths because they didn't record during the apartheid years. So then that is the difference. And they said, aha, that must be the AIDS pandemic. And therefore, we need a $1 billion program to solve.
Yeah.
To solve this fraud. So over and over, you see the same techniques being happened. It's fear, science by media, and say it becomes scientism in a certain sense. Radiation's another one, which I think we can talk to about. Please.
Yeah. What I find, really astonishing. And, we talk about me and my girlfriend, especially just mentioned our 2-year-old daughter off the record. And we're thinking, we're definitely going to do homeschooling. we're definitely not going to send our school into, there's people, we're in Austria, but there's people in Germany. I used to know that just for the purpose, so that in order not to send their kids into school, they moved out of Germany. They went to Paraguay, so this is how bad it is, like the indoctrination camp. And I woke up, thankfully, a few decades ago, about this whole, the whole matrix,
it's one lie after another.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the problem is if you say one doesn't make sense, they say, okay, you're a bit crazy. Now, if you say 2, 3, you're already a conspiracy theorist. You're really crazy in the process, right? Yeah. So you can't win against the establishment narrative in a certain sense. You can only do it for yourself. I mean, you said you send your daughter to private schools or your child, I have some empathy with that view. But on the other hand, I went through schools in South Africa towards the end of the apartheid era. They had the same level of indoctrination. Yeah. I think when I woke up was about 10 or 11. And we were still being taught the old apartheid era. So all these great white leaders of South Africa. Then the curriculum changed. So the government, the system took time to catch up with the new dogma. And then they said, look at our new great leaders. And the old leaders are enemies. And I realized a child old, that doesn't add up. So, I think if somebody goes to a government school, I'm not against that because most parents can't afford homeschooling. I think you must just try and encourage your child to think for himself and do not trust everything that your teacher tells him. And I think they'll be okay. It doesn't matter which system they go through.
I think, I used to go to a very, conservative, very so-called elite schools in Austria and Vienna. And I also studied law. I even did a PhD later on, but I mean, it depends also, you know, what kind of friends you have, what's the environment, what kind of you know, people you interact with, what kind of experiences. I also spent like 5 years in the United States, you know, back and forth between Austria and the United States. So I guess it's also that it depends, you know, on the depth or the degree of, you know, inspirations you get, the conversations you have, the experiences you have, you know. So it's not everybody that wakes up, but still, I mean, after decades, you know, of mainstream and conventional, you know, indoctrination, dogmatization, you begin asking yourself, like, what have I really like learned in school? Like, did we ever learn to question anything? Did we ever learn to question? Like, I mean, I used to have like super grades, you know, in all those subjects, not like mathematics, but like chemistry, physics, all these like geography, all these things, but I, you know, we never learned like to question the narrative, you know, the things that are just.
But the school is not there to make you question things. It's to indoctrinate exactly. You. So indoctrinate enough people to pass through the system to become very good managerial, you know, elites of the system. And I think most people actually fall out. Most people are halfway through saying, I can't take this crap anymore. I just can't, you know, continue with this nonsense. And they fall out and we call them dropouts. So we call them, you know, children who disrupt class or things of that sort. But I think they sometimes the guys you need to listen to because they just can't stand it. So the system selects for obedience and conformity. And look, I'm you know, a product of the system to a large extent. And to some point, you know, you just put your head down. You say, this doesn't make sense. There's stupidity, but I have to do it to pass through it. And I think those things have a function as well. The stupid exercises, the stupid questions, they are there to really select those who can be as obedient as long as possible. And that's what the system selects for. So that's how I understand the purpose of modern education.
Yeah. And, you know, it relates to every other, you know, topic or, you know, connection that you're trying to make. It's everything is so interconnected, but they don't teach you that.
I don't think anyone can teach it for you. I think you one day wake up and you're like, okay, I've been lied to about this, this, and this, and what else isn't true? And how do I know what's true? You know, that's difficult because now, am I going crazy? Am I paranoid? And I don't think some people have gone that route. I don't think you need to be. I think if you understand one topic, I would encourage people to read up is on propaganda, just the history of it. You know, we think propaganda is something they did in Nazi Germany. Well, yeah, they did, but they also do it in modern societies. And the techniques they are using are very similar. It's advertising. It is the manufacture of consent of Chomsky and Erman, you know. It is Walter Lippmann, Edward Bernays, all these using psychology to manipulate the population.
Yeah.
And if you understand those techniques, right? You'll see through a lot of this stuff, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. When I read that book about, because my PhD work was on the product liability or liability of the cigarette corporations or tobacco industry, you know, about the highly engineered and highly engineered manipulated drug delivery device or nicotine delivery device. And it just, you know, the rabbit hole was so fucking, I'm sorry, my language was so fucking deep. It just, you know, beginning with the addictive enhancing technologies, marketing to or studying on of behaviors of 3 to 5 year old children. And you know, it really, the rabbit hole goes super deep. So, and then I, you know, I read this book about, you just named him, sorry.
Edward Bernays.
Yeah, exactly. Edward Bernays. It was a nephew of Sigmund Freud. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So that opened my eyes. Like they had their own like really super sophisticated public relation and advertising and marketing strategies, how to send, you know, they connected it with emancipation, you know, of women, sent women out. They had their own photographers and cameramen, you know, and their own,
If you want to go down the rabbit hole, which is even worse than tobacco, it's the sugar industry.
Yeah.
But
the sugar industry learned actually the strategies from tobacco, some people have argued.
Gary Taubes wrote the book, The Case Against Sugar, and he argues the tobacco industry manipulated the sugar. But I mean, I find many of the childhood cartoons we saw, like, let's get an ice cream, little cartoon man goes, you know, let's lick this. It's all to brand sugar at one stage. So, you know, there's a lot of this stuff going on. And unfortunately, we live in a modern society where we're just flooded with ads.
Yeah.
Like it is constantly. Most of the messaging you get from, especially corporate funded media, is going to be distorted to present some kind of agenda. You know, even if the information is true and accurate, you know, all propaganda has some element that's true. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. But they, you need to ask yourself always with the media, why am I getting this message at this time and this one? And a good example would be the political elections. So, you know, new candidate comes in Austria, and before you know, 2 weeks before the election is a sex scandal, as if that has ever been, you know, shocking at a politician that had a sex scandal. But now it's in the media, now it's a scandal. Of course, it's about taking him down. It's mafia techniques, right? And they do this all the time with so many topics.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. No, it's a classical pattern. I don't know what to say. I mean, yeah. Let me see. So before we go, I mean, the main topic, of course, I want to talk to you about is, and I know you have a really in-depth knowledge and comprehension about this whole nuclear technology, nuclear deal of Iran. Okay, there is a lot of misconceptions about nuclear technology or radioactivity. Yeah. And, you know, in connection with the nuclear, you know, nuclear weapon technology and everything, what are the misconceptions? What are the stigmatization? What is like the total, a lack of comprehension?
Well, I mean, sort of asking where does one start? First of all, nuclear weapons, let's start there, right? Are destructive. They can make a big boom in a city. But then you have a radiation fallout, right? It's not clear to me that that fallout is dangerous. As dangerous as people think it is. It might be high doses. So the argument about radiation safety standards that we have today was lobbied for by, guess who, the fossil fuel industry. So that was a shocker. And they came up in the 1950s when Eisenhower instructed the U.S., the Bayes Commission in the United States, to look into the effect of radiation on a population, because they did a lot of nuclear bomb tests and background radiation was rising across the world. People were rightfully concerned about this. So Eisenhower gave an instruction to a panel of geneticists to look into it. And this panel of geneticists was stacked by people who worked for, guess who, the Rockefeller Foundation. Okay. The Health Physicist Society of the United States has actually undug it. And I had a conversation with the man who did the most research into it, Dr. Edward Calabrese at the University of Amherst. So they came up with a model which was called LNT, linear no threshold. And this model tells you that no dose of radiation is ever safe, zero. So if you take it to its logical conclusion, if you have an X-ray, you're supposed to die because of cancer. Okay. You're supposed to, if you eat a banana, there you get radiation doses. That's supposed to give you cancer. So that's absolutely not true. Now, there are areas in the world where background radiation is higher than what we consider safe for nuclear plant workers. So nuclear plant workers cannot be exposed to more than 20 millisieverts per year. That's the dosage they use. But if you go to Ramsar, Iran, where I was just 1 month ago, it's 250 millisieverts. Okay, it's something like 10 times higher than background radiation. So they what we consider safe. So obviously those people are not dying. That area is green and lush. That's where the Shah had his holiday palace. Radiation, I'm sorry, it's just not as dangerous as people think. And before this Bayes Committee in the United States came up, the radiation standards were actually reasonable. That is why nuclear power was much more affordable in the 1950s than it is today, because they came with these ridiculous standards that increased the safety requirements, and that almost doubled the price. Now, you can obviously see why the oil industry would want to lobby for something of this sort. And unfortunately, Germany... If you go to Germany today, a lot of the Greens in Germany, they've came to be known as LNT activists, linear no threshold activists. So they're using the fraudulent model to say that radiation causes leukemia in children, it causes this and that, you're going to turn green if you touch it. And consequently, the bad model has convinced an industrial sophisticated society like Germany to get rid of its nuclear weapons. And it's also radicalized the Austrian Greens, for example. So here's a clear example of what we talked about earlier, scientism influencing public policy. And obviously the oil industry is never going to oppose this. The Greens are never going to oppose it because now they have solar and wind panels to sell. But the reality is radiation is not as dangerous. It's a very poor carcinogen. You need a very high dosage to make the carcinogen. And if you look at where this model comes from, because they had scientific studies behind it, in inverted commas, it was a guy who won whose name was Muller. He won the Nobel Prize, I think it's in the 1940s or somewhere. For basically shooting fruit flies with a lot of radiation. So modern radiation safety standards is based on three fruit flies. That's how shocking it is. At the time when they wrote the standards, they had actual human data from the atomic bomb tests in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So it's a repeated experiment. And those things show a very interesting thing. The survivors of the atomic bomb, you can measure it in terms of perimeter. So the radiation closer to the bomb, you have higher radiation. there's a certain level where there's an inverted J shape, where the population has less cancer than the average, than the general population. And that is what we call radiation hormesis. So a certain amount of radiation might be good for you. Now, if you go into the, you're exposed to sunshine, for example, you tan. And, you know, that tan protects you against more sunshine in the future, more UV radiation, okay? So it's the same thing for all radiation. A little bit of it might be good for you. A lot of it is obviously going to kill you. And so we're talking about what they call the hormetic model, the inverted U shape or a J shape if you turn it around. And that's the model that I'm advocating for. And I say, if we base public policy on that, we can make nuclear power much more affordable. We can probably save a lot of people from dying from cancers because people forego radiotherapy because they're scared of radiation, things of that sort. So this is one of the most expensive scientific mistakes in human history.
Fascinating. So it goes... Again, this is like so classical. It goes always back to like fraudulent, not fraudulent, but like false studies or data.
Or bad studies that got promoted for political purposes. Mm-hmm. You know, so even at the time, because what this guy with the fruit flies did is he shot it with a lot of radiation. And he proved that radiation causes gene mutations, which was true at that high dosage. And then they took a line, they extrapolated down.
Right,
and nature doesn't have a straight line, because if you heal from radiation, that's an S-shaped or a J-shaped curve, right? Mm-hmm. And that's sort of how it started. And it was similar to global warming, for example, when Hansen came to Congress. There was no science behind what he said originally. It was just a political agenda.
Exactly.
And this is the same thing. The guy who published it, I don't even blame him, but I blame him for not saying anything after his studies got promoted. Because, you see, when it got promoted, then he became the famous Nobel Prize-winning scientist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so all the ambitions and the incentives were in the direction. And you see this happen over and over again, where the scientific theory is not accepted because it's scientifically proven, but because the group accepts it. It becomes propaganda. And there's the name for this in science. It's called the gold effect. COVID's a very good, because it's named off Atomic Gold, who first came across it. And the COVID's a very good example of this as well.
Yeah.
I mean, the original science that came out of Wuhan was very sloppy. Mm-hmm. And yet we just accepted it, and the media ran with the story, and now we've locked down the world economy, right? Based on something that was very bogus from the beginning.
Yeah, there's so many misconceptions and just narratives. You know, I watched a documentary about Chernobyl a long time ago, and there was an old lady who... very old woman who probably in her 80s or 90s who still lived there.
Yep.
Near Chernobyl, not really like literally near the center. And she was all, you know, she was super healthy. She had a good life. So what does it show? I mean, what does
this show? Well, the consequence of this, I spoke to Wade Ellison, who's a professor he's at Oxford. He's a professor in nuclear physics, and he's one of the biggest skeptics against the LNT model. I spoke to him about it last week, and I asked him this question. He said, well, Chernobyl and Fukushima should never have been evacuated. He wrote an article after the Fukushima accident, and he said everyone can go home 1 week afterwards. That was written for the BBC. They ignored him, and he showed values there, good estimates. His estimates were a little bit off, maybe a bit low, but it doesn't matter. He showed that we should never have evacuated. And there's good evidence for it. The best control group is the animals at Chernobyl, because animals don't watch scary Hollywood films, right? And the animals are fine. They are birds staying in a sarcophagus.
Amazing.
Okay, so the birds are radioactive, yeah, but they're fine. So what does it tell you? It tells you that what we've been told about radiation is complete bogus. But you see, now you'd extend this to geopolitics, because the threat of nuclear weapons is not just the big blast, it is the fallout, it is the dangers, it's the nuclear winter. And I'm saying a lot of this stuff is, there's no evidence for that.
Right.
You know? So it means that we should not be as scared of nuclear weapons. I'm still scared of the blast. I mean, I wouldn't accept that. But I'm not scared of living in an area that's been hit by a nuclear bomb. Another interesting stat is if you take Utah, so Utah is next to Nevada in the US. In Nevada, they dropped 12 nuclear bombs. The fallout went over villages in Utah that had no protection. Utah has the lowest rate of cancer in the United States.
Incredible. Mm-hmm.
Right. So it shows you again this hormetic curve. A little bit of radiation might be good for you.
Okay. But fear is the main component. Like, why do you think that's why the blocking, or I don't know what you call it, the delaying of further development or building of new nuclear reactors, is that fear that's been instilled into the society? That's like,
but you see, the fear is informed from a model that tells you no dose is safe. Okay, and now I appeal to human imagination. I make Hollywood films. I make a series like Chernobyl, and I show all this danger. And, you know, so the media has a very good story. And it also happened in the backdrop of the Cold War, where there was this nuclear scare going on. So all of that imagination is driving the fear. But my view is, if the regulators come one day and they actually just review the models, and the French regulators actually done it, but they put it in secret, they don't put it publicly. French regulators have said at least by a factor of 10, we can relax our safety standards. The French, I think it's French Radiological Society, the US Health Physicists Society has said the same thing, but the national regulators have not made that statement yet because they're too scared. Because it would be an admission that what they've been telling people for the last, well, how many years, 60, 70 years, is complete nonsense.
They would lose not only their face, but like totally like credibility.
Well, I mean, the consequence is you have to fire half the guys working in nuclear safety. You don't need them anymore. Uh-huh. You probably don't need many of the arms of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And all the scary story about Iran and having nuclear weapons and things like that, we can calm down a little bit, because essentially what I'm saying is a nuclear weapon is no better than bombing a city with a lot of all conventional bombs. And if you look at the data, it's supported by that. The amount of people who died in Hiroshima is very similar to those who died during the bombing of Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so is a nuclear weapon really as dangerous compared to conventional weapons? I don't think so, you know, from that perspective. Yes, one blast is, but they're actually very useless in a war.
Right, right. Okay, so you mentioned Iran already. So let's go into like into this subject. So I know for a fact that a lot of preparation went into you know, the what do you call it, until this nuclear deal. What was it called? Joint Comprehensive.
JCPOA. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of preparation, a long time. I think it was like 6, 7, 8 years, I don't know, but like many years of preparation went to this diplomatic, you know, consultation or whatever, like negotiations, talks, all kinds of, you know, inspections, probably all kinds of things went on. And then who came? Then came Trump. Because Obama was like totally right. He was wasn't he the initiator? I mean, I'm not a fan of Obama whatsoever, but was he like the initiator of this nuclear deal?
So, I mean, I'll give you the backdrop of it. I think it's important. So we know that the United States used false evidence to show that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. That evidence was handed over to the German intelligence by an Iraqi scientist who went under the name of Curveball at the time in 2003. And the German intelligence flagged this source and said, this is dodgy. You should not trust him. The U.S. just accepted it and said, well, we have evidence Saddam has WMDs and the anthrax scare came and the invasion of Iraq came. Okay. At the same time, German intelligence received another tip-off from that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. Now, if you look at the history of Iran's nuclear weapons program, Iran had a program under the Shah. When Khomeini came to power in 1979, he said nuclear power is from the devil. Okay. He did not like, he made a religious conviction against nuclear power. Okay. They were skeptical. They cut the budget of the Iranian nuclear research at the time. Then in the 90s, the thinking started changing in Iran. They said, well, we need to finish the reactor at Bushehr. Iran's only got one nuclear reactor in Bushehr. But to do nuclear power, you need enrichment. So the United States at the time was forcing Iran, did not want Iran to have a domestic nuclear weapon, a nuclear power program. And they forced the French and the Germans, and the French supplied most of the enrichment to Iran at the time, to stop dealing with Iran. So then Iranians decided, well, we're going to do our own enrichment. So they went on the black market, and they bought it from what was called the Khan Group. It's groups in Pakistan, who incidentally the same group that helped South Africa achieve their nuclear weapons. But none of this was ever in violation of the non-proliferation treaty. In fact, Iran openly disclosed them, and they said to the IAEA, this is what we intend to do, and you can come and check and safeguard us. So Iran at no point has ever violated the non-proliferation treaty. This is very important to communicate. Then comes 2003, the Iraq war is ongoing, and the Bush administration is looking for a war narrative for the invasion of Iran, because the saying was the road to Tehran goes through Baghdad. So what happens? The Israeli intelligence agency Mossad hands over fabricated evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapons program to what is called the MEK, the Mujahideen-e Khalq. Now, they're a terrorist group staying in Paris, and they hand it over to German intelligence. Okay, the Germans already flagged it and say, guys, this is just ridiculous. Okay, USA, the CIA makes an estimate in 2005 based on the 2003 evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapons program, and At the same time, the head of the German intelligence, he goes to the Wall Street Journal and he said, guys, why is Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, saying Iran has nuclear weapons based on stuff that we flagged as unreliable evidence? Okay, so the United States ran a war narrative based on falsified evidence. And until today, there's no evidence that Iran has ever had a nuclear weapons program. They have their own enrichment program. They have a nuclear capability program. Now, it's very important to distinguish it. Their argument is we can spin enough centrifuges for attention, but we don't get a weapon. Okay, and that is the same policy that's consistent since the time of the Shah.
Exactly.
In fact,
let me ask you, let me interrupt you just quick, because you said in Boucher, right? Was it in Boucher? So in Boucher, there was this still sort of, it was sort of...
it was incomplete reactor,
Incomplete, but that was from the Shah times, right?
Yeah.
But was there a plan like under Shah? Because, I mean, the Shah was sort of a more or less a puppet of the...
He was a puppet of the USA. Look, the Shah in Isfahan, there was a research laboratory. But as far as we know, all of the programs of the Shah that had military applications, it wasn't even sure if he had one, to be honest. Gareth Porter wrote about this in his book, The Manufactured Crisis. You know, all of those things were closed down by the revolutionary government. They cut the funding. Many of the Iranian scientists of the time left, and they went for the United States. So it was, and the reason for this is important. During the Iran-Iraq war, we know Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons against Iran. Iran has been, it's the only country since the First World War to have suffered chemical burns. And the Iranian doctors are the world's experts in treating people with chemical and biological wounds. Okay. Khomeini issued a fatwa at the time against chemical and biological and nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Okay. And he made the argument that if we do use these weapons, we are no better than Saddam Hussein. So if you use, I mean, if you know anything from Iranian society, the Iran-Iraq war is a big deal over there. And if you use that as a basis for any decision, that's usually a decision that's final. So there's a fatwa against nuclear weapons. And when Khamenei came to power until 2012, was the last time he made a statement, I believe, he said that we don't want nuclear weapons. He made it absolutely clear. And that was understood by everyone. Now, there was a time in the 90s when rogue elements within the IRCG and the Iranian defense tried to develop a clandestine nuclear weapons program. They only had a small laboratory of some sort. Khamenei figured this out after he became supreme leader, and he said, absolutely not, you're going to close that thing down. Okay, so Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. In fact, Iran has gone further, and they've asked for a nuclear weapons Middle East free zone.
This is a point that's like totally suppressed. To be honest with you, I'm from Iran. I was born in 1972, born in 1979. I moved to Austria with my dad, with my father, and then, spent some, I'm really frank about this. I'm not a fan of the Iranian regime.
I don't want a war.
Exactly, yeah. Or about Islam. But no, I'm just saying it for the objectivity. I gotta leave it. I mean, the wisdom that they had, not only regarding the nuclear, non-development of nuclear technology or nuclear bombs, but also the development and the advancement of other technologies.
Yeah.
Because I think they had this wisdom, especially on the Khamenei. He said, you know what? It's time that other people copy us and not we copy the others. You know, so the philosophy was behind that, and that's, I think, it takes a lot of wisdom to. Within 40 years at least, since 1979, since the revolution, to bring in the brightest, most intelligent, most creative people within engineering, nuclear science, and then eventually we could talk about plasma technology when it comes to defense technology, to develop and think on your own and develop technologies that have not been developed yet or that just were.
Yeah, look, there's a lot of nuance to these things. I mean, as I say, I'm no fan or proponent of any religious government either, right? So I feel very similar to you about it. And I think that government can reform itself in many ways, in very simplistic ways to change. But we need to understand the geopolitics of this if we're honest about the whole thing. And I just want to say that nuclear weapons free zone treaty is important. Okay, this is something that Noam Chomsky told me. If we implement that treaty, And all it takes is for the United States to put pressure on Israel to open up their nuclear weapons for inspections, which they obviously won't do, because we know Israel has never signed the non-proliferation treaty, and they probably have 70 warheads, right? But if that happens, the entire Middle East will be nuclear weapons free. And then this whole issue, you don't need a JCPOA, you don't need anything, because we know International Atomic Energy Agency inspections work. Iran is subjected to intense inspections. The facility at Natanz has been hacked by the United States and Israel at one stage. And again, there's no indication that they have a nuclear weapons program. At the moment, I think they're going for 60% enrichment because they know you can use that in submarines. So they're cleverly playing with the nuances and the laws, but they haven't gone for a full bomb. Because even if you get 80 or 90% enrichment you need for a weapon, you still need a weapon design program. You still need a military program behind that. It's not that simple. You know, are there people in Iran who might want a nuclear weapon? I don't doubt it. Sure, there are people in the government who would like to overturn the fatwa. But as long as that fatwa remains in power, in effect, I don't think they will have a nuclear weapon. And, you know, if what I'm saying is true over here, and I say this given Gareth Porter's work, it means that the basis for a lot of the sanctions, the basis for a lot of the militarism in the Middle East is complete nonsense. There's no need for that.
And to be honest with you, I mean, seriously, I mean, if Iran really wanted an any kind of, you know, whatever size or density or whatever, I mean, I'm not a specialist on nuclear bombs, but if they really wanted a nuclear bomb, I mean, they could have gotten it or somehow, you know, either
they
developed
could have
gotten it
years ago. I mean, South Africa took 8 years to get ours.
Probably, don't you think? I mean,
they have not shown intention because they know that if they develop that thing, first of all, you can't use it. Okay, they've got one bomb. Israel's got 70.
And why would they need it? I mean, unless you know, you're a total psychopath, just offensively want to destroy, and you know.
I mean, they will be so isolated diplomatically by both Russia and China as well, who will not tolerate that. Mm-hmm. So you know, they figured out that it's best to have a few centrifuges to get the attention of America and Israel if they want to, and those centrifuges remain there to say we can do it theoretically, and I think that's their program, and we should not make more out of it, and it makes complete sense from their point of view, because if Iran, for example, has a bomb program tomorrow, what will the UAE, what will Egypt, what will all those countries in the region do? They will want one as well.
Exactly.
So the fact that they don't have one, and by the way, what I'm saying here has been accepted by the Pentagon. It's accepted by the CIA assessment, reassessment. 2005 was wrong. The latest one, I think 2009, said they don't have a program. And even Mossad made the admission. Now, I mean, if Israeli intelligence is saying this, I mean, it means they know what's going on.
So let's talk about because on the other hand, you know, Iran doesn't need for defense, even for defensive purposes. Why would you need, you know, nuclear bombs or whatever, nuclear bomb technologies?
Yeah, they're useless. The nuclear bomb is very useless.
No, because the traditional rocket technologies or whatever, missile technologies or other, military technology, in my knowledge and from other experts I heard, is so super advanced, in some parts even ahead of some other countries.
What I know is they have developed hypersonic missiles, but you know, you don't even need sophisticated weapons.
Yeah.
If on the opposite side of the Persian Gulf, so if you go to Bushehr, there's, I think, a base of the IRCG is there, and there's two military bases, two Air Force bases. From Bushehr and from the Persian Gulf area, they can launch a ton of rockets into the Saudi Arabian oil fields on the opposite side. You don't need sophisticated weapons for that. And you can bring the world economy to a halt if they want to. Okay, that is their deterrence. Their deterrence is basically, if you attack us, we're going to blow up the Middle East, right? Which is a very good deterrent study. Then the other deterrence they have is they've been arming in groups in Hezbollah and in Hamas, although Hamas is not a very good ally of Iran to begin. But Hezbollah was basically to try and pin down Israeli to get them on sort of parity. And even Israeli intelligence has admitted this. So that is sort of the geopolitical strategy. You know, I personally would like to see them change their approach, because first, I would like to see a more diplomatic relations between Iran and Israel, which from where you and I are standing seems almost impossible sometimes.
Yeah.
And between the United States, I would like for the U.S. embassy to reopen there and then to start diplomatic relations. And then whatever problem we have, we can work out. And, you know, also stop imprisoning so many people that speak out against the government, you know, basic things like that. But that, in my view, should be our attitude to Iran. It's just like, stop this war talk, because it hasn't worked since the Iranian Revolution. Every time you try and impose sanctions or you try and be harsh with them, what's going to happen? They're going to be, they can embolden the hardliners to get into power, and they're going to be more militarized in the process.
Exactly. And I think I was trying to allude to the fact that, remember that scene of that general, was it from Pentagon or something, Joint Chief of, maybe it was from Pentagon. Remember when he talked on an interview, like what would have been the military strategy, like after Iraq, you know, and then Syria, and then eventually, you know, so
the Wesley Clark, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, do you sometimes, I mean, what's your opinion? Like, why hasn't Iran been attacked yet? Is it
a very good question?
They can't, I mean, it would be a suicidal mission, or is Iran already within, you know, the last 3-4 decades has become so strong militarily, defensively, and technologically that
I think it has to do with the United States' utter blunder in the US invasion of Iraq. The United States invaded Iraq, and they basically gave Iraq, which is a majority Shiite country, to Iran on a silver platter. So Iranian diplomatic relations with Iraq has never been better. The United States, by invading Iraq, made one of the biggest geopolitical mistakes in the century. And they've been systemically negotiated out of the Middle East by not just the Iranians, by the Iraqis, even by Saudis at this stage, the Saudis Chinese. The other thing is, I don't think the oil is as important for America anymore. We have newer technologies, even the solar and wind, to the extent they work. The United States only gets 7% of the Middle Eastern oil anyways. And the United States military has basically been subsidizing the Chinese economy because China imported most of the Middle Eastern oil. And I think there's a willingness and a fatigue on the American side to not be engaged in the Middle East. I don't doubt for a minute, though, that there are some new conservative voices in America that still wants to see the project of the new American century in the Middle East implemented. But they failed in Iraq. It was the fact that the Iraqis actually saved Iran from being invaded. Because had the invasion of Iraq been a success, and had there not been a political change in America, I'm not sure if Iran wouldn't have been invaded, because there were clear battle plans drawn up for the invasion of Iran. And the United States today can still invade Iran if they want to, but they're going to, there has been so much resistance within America, I think, against these type of wars. I mean, look at Afghanistan. The United States left Afghanistan. You know, they've actually helped Iran in the process of this whole thing.
How much of this, if you just zoom out a little bit, how much of that is theater?
Good question. I don't know.
You know, that's always like a question that's, you know, pounding in my head back there. Like, how much of it is really, you know, do they get along in the background? I mean, how much of it is a show, you know?
Well, Iran is a very strange enemy, because Iran helped America identify the Afghan targets during the invasion. Iran, you know, they had support for America during 9/11. They even helped sign a nuclear deal. They were cooperative. So there has been forms of cooperation between Iran and the United States. Now, is it just a real politic on both their sides that they say this is it, or are they working behind the scenes? I don't know. I don't think any of us can really tell.
The Jewish people, I mean, there are so many Jewish people, even especially Orthodox Jewish people, who are totally, I mean, just remember Ahmadinejad, you know, I mean, you don't see those videos or photos where they hug each other, you know, and there's a huge, you know, support for the Orthodox Jewish, you know, traditional Jewish population. There's a huge, you know, Jewish community and society in Iran. So
they haven't left yet, which is,
to be honest with you, there needs to be a distinction between the ideology, you know, the hardcore, you know, mafia-like Zionists, and the Jewish people, because we always got along with Jewish people, right?
I mean, my grandfather was Jewish as well. So, you know, I've got the Jews in Tehran haven't left, as far as I understand it.
That's the reason I'm asking. You know, it's just how much theater is it?
I think a lot of it is theater, because as Gareth Porter explained to me, Israeli tactic has been to try and pin down the United States in the Middle East, because Israel creates the perception that Iraq is dangerous, the perception that Iran is dangerous, okay? And the perception that Israel will attack Iran tomorrow. But Israel does not have the refueling capability to even take on Hezbollah, okay? So Israel is a bit of a paper tiger type of economy. So Israel wants the United States to be in the Middle East for its own security. But does Israel Netanyahu really have the intention to go to Iran and come back? I think privately they are far more cautious in their threats. And maybe they're negotiating more behind the scenes, you know. And I think it's, a lot of this is true in Iran as well, because, you know, if you go to the north of Tehran, that is where the government officials stay and the wives of the sanction busters, right? Those people live like they're in the West. The women don't wear hijab, for example. They having big houses, big cars. They live like a middle-class lifestyle. So these are the guys running the society, making the rules. But I think they're trying to appeal to the section of the society that still believes in the propaganda all the time.
Exactly.
But I think a lot of it is just, say, it's a combination between theater and empty threats.
Yeah, I mean, I did, you know, really went into a lot of rabbit holes, but it's even for some experts, I think it's some, a little bit, I don't know, it's just so much this, so much vial of, manipulation and distractions and geopolitics, you know. But I mean, I'm always trying, you know, that's why I'm a huge fan of Bitcoin, by the way, because I think that's the root of it. Because who controls the money or the issuance of money or the issuance of credit, you know, or the entities that are above the law, you know, the City of London, the Bank of International Settlements, the central banks, like who, like, and as far as I know, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but is Iran not one of the very few countries that is not sort of dominated by or possessed by the sort of what do you call it, central bank?
Well, their bank is cut off from the SWIFT system.
Okay. Yeah,
but they also have their own central banks, and they've also talked about CBDCs.
Yeah, see, yeah. So,
what does that tell you? I don't
exactly.
know.
Yeah. That's why, you know, we need Bitcoin, because that's the only form of information, actually.
Well, I will say this. I learned this when I was now in Iran. You know, Iranians love trading gold. I've appreciated, you know, I know people talk about gold, but I never understood it, you know, in an abstract sense. But at the end of the month, every Iranian takes what's left of his salary to buy gold to escape inflation.
Yeah.
And there's this massive, you go to Isfahan, you see these massive, traders. So I thought that's clever. I'm still divided. Should I buy gold or Bitcoin? Which one is better? You know, I still feel like gold is like I can see it and touch it type of thing to it, you know.
If you're physically like obsessed, buy gold. Well, I mean, it wouldn't harm you, of course, but long term, in terms of exponential by orders of magnitude increase of purchasing power, because I mean, come on, I mean, just look at it seriously. I mean, every fiat currency, every fiat money, that's been printed out of thin air. And we had a very short time span where literally money was gold backed, right?
Yeah.
But that was la belle époque, or whatever it's called, that, you know, where even the technologies evolved and everything else and the society evolved, because it was hard money. But Bitcoin is the hardest money. It is the scarcest money. It is the really, truly one and only unconfiscatable, immutable.
But do you think the government can't confiscate it?
No,
I mean,
definitely not. No, because I can memorize right now 12 words. If you want, I can go to any country across any border, and they can strip search, you know, make me totally naked and strip search me, and they can do anything. What I mean, right? Even if they put a gun into my head, I mean, yeah, of course, yeah, I could no, tell.
I've thought that they can just attack these big miners and then force them all to.
No, that's been debunked. Literally by dozens of experts, and it would take such an astronomical power, you know, and it's too late. They should have done that, when the Genesis block, or when Satoshi Nakamoto sort of created the pseudonymous Satoshi Nakamoto in the very first years. That was the time, the only time they could have what do you call it in English, made it totally obsolete and destroyed it, you know. But now it's too late. The cat is out of the bag after literally like 14 years now.
Okay, well, I still have some Bitcoin close to me. I don't put all my money, my faith in it.
Keep it, put it on a cold storage. Don't put it on exchange, and just keep it. Seriously.
I still have the words memorized here. So those 12 words,
So engineers talking to me. I could do that. I could memorize probably, but there's other ways, like border wallets. You know, you can memorize like a pattern, and that's all you need. You know,
well, I guess somebody can steal your 12 words. They can also steal your gold. You know, so nothing is entirely safe from that perspective. But still,
exactly. And how do you verify the authenticity and the genuine authenticity of gold? That's another problem. You know, like how do you want to trade like through time and space? This is why, you know, Bitcoin makes everything else obsolete. I mean, it's really a truly phenomenon, and it's a truly monetary evolution, to be honest with you. I mean, it took me some years, you know, and I'm not the only one, by the way. There's like super intelligent people out there who are like, you know, grew up with Bitcoin, and they say, you know, it's just so mind-boggling, so amazing what kind of facets and aspects Bitcoin has that they just didn't get it at the beginning, you know.
I was looking at the performance of Bitcoin compared to South African rand and the Argentina peso and things of that sort, and it's doing better than many currencies, you know. So I mean, I was in I remember when Zimbabwe had hyperinflation years ago, because I grew up with Zimbabweans who fled from Mugabe's persecution. And when hyperinflation hit, they did something very clever. They started buying assets of people fleeing the country. So people would run away. They bought their cars. They bought motorcycles. They bought furniture, anything they could find, right? And they would just drive it to the border to South Africa and exchange it for rands. And they became millionaires overnight. So even when there was hyperinflation, there was a way to make money. So, you know, if ever you see that happening in Europe or which of a country, remember, there are ways to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, fascinating. And, you know, I mean, it's just a matter of time, to be honest with you. I think it's the rate of speed, the all these processes are ongoing right now, the developments, you know, monetary, geopolitically, hyperinflation. I mean, we literally have hyperinflation already, actually, in specified like products or services. We already have, because officially, I think we are talking, people talk about hyperinflation when it exceeds or at least like 50% or something like that. But we already have products or services or whatever, you know, that already exceeds that, you know, by far. But anyway, it's coming, and there is no way around it. You know, I mean, just look at the global debt with all the unfunded liabilities and the derivatives.
Nobody's going to pay back the money. So we're all wishing that I'm going to be dead before the debt comes.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm not an economist or an investor, so I don't, you know, have professed any serious knowledge about it, but just the amount of money that people owe, it just doesn't add up to me, you know.
It just doesn't add up. No, we're talking about like 2 quadrillion, yeah, but just look at like individual countries, their official debt, you know, not even counting the unfunded liabilities and the derivatives, you know. It's mind-boggling, you know. But okay, let me ask you, because I know I don't want to take too much time of you. Hugo, so if you zoom out a little bit, what do you see like in the next few years, like in terms of nuclear technology? Are we going to see like, a sort of a technological evolution, abundance, prosperity?
Difficult saying it, because, you know, the energy transition takes, in the past at least, took 30 years per transition. So it's a lifetime for most, half a lifetime for most people, right? Nuclear, we're a bit in trouble, because I'll be honest, I mean, I'm a proponent of nuclear, but if you have governments, you know, passing policies to make nuclear more strict and can't develop it, there will be no innovation in that field. We need to deregulate nuclear before we can, you know, make it work again. The best, most optimistic scenario for a new reactor in Japan is 15 years, right? That is, if they make the decision now and they're still hovering about it. Germany just shut it down. In Europe, we're struggling a little bit because the French can't build them on time. You know, these are issues that the industry has to face. The guys who are building them on time, unfortunately, are the Russians and the South Koreans. So if we're going to see innovation, it will come from South Korea. I'm optimistic about what's happening there. They built a reactor in Dubai. Russia's building some in Egypt, but Russian reactors might be sanctioned. I know Poland has shown a great interest in nuclear reactors. Some people have talked about SMRs, but all these things will take a few decades to build, if I'm like truly honest with you. If I'm a salesman, I'll tell you, yes, put your money into it right now. But because we did not invest and train engineers for such a long period in Europe, there's a skills deficit, there's a knowledge deficit. So all these things has to be retained. And then you need to have politicians with long-term vision, you know, unfortunately, because every nuclear development, at least in the past, has been highly tied to a government that's been favorable to the technology. And it's so easy for governments just to shut it down. So it's one of those tragedy things that I don't think I'm going to see that in the energy sector anytime soon. I worked at ITER, the International Thermonuclear Reactor, where they're trying to do fusion. When I was there, they said it would start the first experiment this year. Now they're saying 2025, and I realized they already had a date before I arrived, which was 2018. So these things are getting delayed, and that's the reality of it. Even that announcement they made in the United States about achieving fusion, well, they were not honest about what they did. If you look at the energy going into the experiment, they did achieve what I call Q greater than one, more energy out and in. But if you look at the energy going into the building of that step down by transformers, they didn't achieve it, right?
Okay. So is there a lack of resource? Because I don't think it would take so much money. I mean, relatively speaking, maybe a few hundred million dollars.
It's just a lack of dedication and leadership, I think. I mean, if you look at the amount of money they're spending on renewables at the moment, you can easily take 10% of that and build a few reactors.
Exactly. Yeah.
And get the cost down. Mm. And it's a question of standardizing to one design and then building it out, which is what Germany and France used to do when they built when they did quite well. But the Germans, to say, they've climbed out of nuclear, and France is recommitting, but recommission, it's not on and off switch, you know, because we're stuck in the Silicon Valley, even Bitcoin mindset, where, you know, you can just type a few computer codes and the thing changes. It's not the way in the physical world. Yeah. It takes longer, you know.
What about other forms of energy? I mean, do you see any other,
at the next 10 decade or so, I think the expansion is going to be solar. I'm not against solar, by the way. Wind, I think, is a little bit horrible just for the environmental stuff.
What about hydrogen? Hydrogen, I don't know, conversion,
hydrogen's got issues. So hydrogen, to make it, you lose 75% of the energy in the process just before you make it. Mm-hmm. There was a calculation done in France 2019, okay, which is called Hydrogen Aviation's Hype, by a French astronomer called Michel Corriat. And he showed just to run Charles de Gaulle Airport, right, you need to use 4 nuclear power stations to make it efficiently using electrolysis. So there's a lot of hype about hydrogen. I think in the short future, you're going to see solar panels expanding with natural gas. And I don't see an end for natural gas at this stage. A lot of people have been wishing the end of fossil fuels, but I see fossil fuels as sort of like the midwife that catches the baby. If none of these technologies work adequately, we use fossil fuels. There's a lot of talk of combining solar panels and wind with heat pumps and things of that sort. And some of this stuff makes sense. Some of it is just bad investment. So I think for the next decade, we're going to see a lot of money being pushed in that direction, whether we like it or not. Personally, I'm skeptical about it, but that's the reality. That's what I'm seeing in the industry. And after the economics come in, I think it will be a good time to have a good conversation of what we should have done, which is put our money into nuclear power.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
but it's a phase that humans have gone through. I don't think it's the end of the world like some people preach. I'm quite an optimist for the human future. But I do think that we're making some just obvious strategic blunders about our investment in energy. But that's the way it is, you know.
You mentioned, the term fossil fuel, because I mean, I used to read a lot about this. Mm-hmm. And I think the Russians, weren't the Russians like decades ago ahead of us, like in terms of understanding, like.
Well, there's a question if they're abiogenic, right? Tommy Gold, who I spoke about earlier.
He was like.
Well, there's a theory that they made inside of the Earth.
But within
thermodynamic decay.
Does it like take 4 or 5 years even to regenerate itself? I'm not sure. I'm just.
Well, methane definitely does regenerate. Some methane is abiogenic. Mm-hmm. But the critique against that argument has been fossil fuels is found in deposits that are located closer to the Earth. And is that really from the thermodynamic decay from underneath, or is it from the plant matter? That's a debate.
Okay.
So it's still an open question type of thing. Okay. I honestly don't know. There's a lot of people with, you know, theory that's all abiogenic, and we're never going to run out of it. I don't think we're going to run out of it anyway in this century.
Yeah, me neither. That's a point that I was trying to make. We're not like, you know, it's like.
No, I think Saudi Arabia has enough for the world for 150 years and Iran for 250 or something. So like we're okay, you know, if the Middle East supplies us. So
we're not going to run out of
And we can remake them with synthetic fields. There's lots of, like, we're not going to run out of fields. I think that's the false. But whether their origin is abiogenic or biotic, or abiotic or biotic, I think it is. I can't remember the terms now. You know, is it plant matter or is it thermodynamic decay from the earth? That is the question that some geologists are debating. And you're right, the Russians had the theory. But in the West, the guy who had it was Tommy Gold, the guy who the Gold effect is named after, because he questioned the dogma. And Freeman Dyson, who was also a climate skeptic, incidentally, and a great scientist who replaced Einstein and Princeton, he said he thinks Tommy Gold is correct. So that guy said, and that's where the story comes from. So there's a very good book called The Myth of Fossil Fuels.
That's
written by Tommy Gold, yeah.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Got a word to that. Mr. Fossil. Well, anyway, Hugo, I just think, you know, we need to stay, you know, have an open mind and just, you know, that's why I'm asking these questions, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions and fallacies in thinking or I don't know, dogmas that we have just, you know.
I think question everything, right? I think that is the answer for you and your audience. And even if they disagree with both of us, great. You know, tell us why we're wrong. You know, tell us why we're idiots. That's part of the discussion, you know.
Well, Hugo, is there anything else we should have mentioned, or did you? Is there anything you want to besides, like, you should definitely tell my listeners where they can find you, your Substack.
Yeah, so I've got a Substack account. It's I think it's hkruger@substack.com, but it's on my Twitter. You can find me on Twitter. I've got a YouTube channel, and I sometimes write for actually mainstream publications. So I've written for Unheard, I've written for Spike, and for Newsweek.
Oh, really?
And, wow. Yeah. Some of my articles appear usually with Joel Kotkin, who wrote a book called, I should just promote his work as well, called Neo-Feudalism, A Warning to the Middle Class. He wrote a new book, Coming of Neo-Feudalism. And he's basically saying the green policies and the policies we're posing now is creating a new feudal society.
Oh, that's overdue. Yeah, we should talk about that. Yeah.
And I think that is a very, very good critique against modern society. That
absolutely.
We are living in, I mean, it's feudalism. I mean, the fact that Bill Gates can take his aeroplane and I need to check my carbon footprint, that's feudalism.
Oh my God, right? This is beyond hypocrisy, right? Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. But that's what feudalism was about in the Middle Ages, and that's what we're heading into because of the inequality. So, yeah.
Yeah, and definitely my listeners should check that out. And anything else? Any other, anything up? Is there anything upcoming, like publications or books or I don't know?
No, I'm just writing an article at the moment that should be in Propaganda and Focus within the next few weeks about Iran and the misconceptions of Iran.
Oh, that's going to be exciting. Okay.
And yeah, that's what I'm currently occupying with. And other than that, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for your time and sharing your knowledge. And hopefully we can talk maybe in half a year or so again.
All right. That's great. Thanks, Kevin.
Okay, Hugo. Thanks a lot. Okay. Talk to you soon. Take care. Bye.